From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There is more rain in the forecast in parts of the central and southern U.S. after intense flooding along the Ohio River. In Europe, it snowed this week in Rome. A weather system from Siberia called the Beast from the East is bringing snow and ice and very cold temperatures across Western Europe. And that storm may be related to what's happening in the Arctic and is of great concern to climate scientists. The temperatures there have been more than 45 degrees above normal this month, the highest level ever recorded for that region. Joining us now on Skype from Tromsø, Norway, in the Arctic Circle is Robert Graham, who's a climate scientist at the Norwegian Polar Institute. Robert, what are you seeing in the Arctic this year and how unusual is it?
Well, I think it's in the long-term climate record, it's pretty unusual. One of the things that we've noticed is that we've seen in the past big storms in the Arctic that can cause temperatures to rise up to sort of minus 5 degrees Celsius compared with the normal temperature of minus 30 degrees Celsius on a few occasions, but the frequency that that's happening in the last sort of 10 years is really increasing. And what's kind of new now is that often in these storms, we see temperatures close to the North Pole going above 0 degrees Celsius in the melting point quite often during winter, the last 4 out of the 5 winters.
And what are the effects of that?
I think the key effect that we're interested in at the Norwegian Polar Institute here is the effect this has on sea ice growth during winter. So in these months when it should be very cold, minus 30 degrees Celsius, the ice should be thickening and growing and becoming more stable so that it can survive throughout the summer melt season. But in recent years, this just isn't happening. When you have these warm temperatures, the ice doesn't have a chance to grow.
How much does what's happening in the Arctic have to do with what's happening right now in Europe and what they're calling the beast from the east that's brought these very cold temperatures and some snow to places that wouldn't usually be getting that right now?
So I think we're still at early days for making any strong connection between those two. But I think that one thing that may be the case is when you have these very cold, stable areas of high pressure in Europe, then this can block the normal path of the jet stream that would usually cut across Europe. So instead, what maybe happened is that you have this big, cold, dense mass of air over Eurasia, and this has deflected the jet stream northwards into the Arctic.
In the Arctic, is it kind of a chicken and egg situation where you've got reduced sea ice, which allows this big storm to come in, and the big storm may also end up reducing the sea ice?
I think it has a sort of chicken and egg, but it's more an amplifying situation. So when you have this storm going through, it warms up the air temperatures, which makes the ice grow less, but it also has very strong winds that can push the ice northwards, further into the Arctic, shrinking the area of ice. It breaks up the ice and it releases a lot of extra heat from the ocean to the atmosphere, which is causing the maximum temperatures observed during these storms to increase even further.
Is it possible for this ice to regrow, or should we assume that's it for certain areas where the ice melts, that it's gone forever?
The ice will regrow. So typically what I would expect to happen after this storm passes through is the temperatures will go back down to normal levels and you will start growing new ice, but probably it will not reach the same thickness as before. And when you have these storms going in, it's melting the older ice. And this is one of the main patterns that we're seeing in the Arctic now, that you have this shift from very thick old ice that's robust and can survive a summer season to thinner ice that's just grown that year that will melt more quickly.
How concerning is this to you?
It's pretty worrying. So in January 2018, this was the lowest ever sea ice extent in the Arctic since we started recording this variable with satellites, so since the late 1970s. So the ice is going pretty rapidly now during the winter season.
What does it mean for sea level rise?
The change in sea ice thickness, this melting, is not going to affect sea level rise in itself because the ice is already in the ocean. But if this leads to a larger warming area of the Arctic, you could start melting land glaciers on Greenland that could contribute to sea level rise.
That's Robert Graham, who's a climate scientist at the Norwegian Polar Institute. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, school resource officers, or SROs, the armed police in about 20% of the country's schools, are responding to President Trump's claims that they are merely armed guards who don't know or love children, and teachers should be armed instead. The president also called Broward County Deputy Scott Peterson a coward. Peterson resigned as SRO at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School after reports that he didn't run into the school during the recent shooting. Yesterday, his lawyer said Peterson thought the shooting was outside the school, and he followed protocol. Well, Don Bridges, president of the National Association of School Resource Officers, represents about 5,000 SROs across the country. Don, you say there's a big difference between an armed posted guard and an SRO?
Yes, there's a tremendous difference. First and foremost, school resource officers are trained law enforcement officers. We employ what we call the triad method, meaning that police officers who become SROs are going to be in the school playing three very important roles. Role number one is law-related educator, getting into the classroom. And I think another role within the education portion of what we do is we do a tremendous amount of staff development training. Most of the staff development training that SROs do is going to be working with our partners in education, teaching educators how to go about preparing their schools for the unthinkable.
Well, you say the unthinkable, but it's also the very rare. It sounds like what you're saying is what a lot of SROs we're hearing from are saying. Chris Bryan at Hoover High in Alabama has spoken out. He says he doesn't stand at the door, like apparently some people think a guard does. He says he roams the hall. He counsels kids who are in-house suspension. He travels with the school's teams. He monitors the security cameras. He looks for drug infractions. He works closely, you know, with the school. He would take a bullet for his kids, he said. But I'm wondering, do SROs also work with, let's say, school social workers and therapists? In the case of the Florida shooting, the shooter was well known as a problem child. He was not allowed to bring a backpack. An email was sent out to teachers saying to keep an eye on him. Would that kind of information be also given to an SRO?
Absolutely. If there is a student that is in crisis, the SRO works in conjunction with the social worker. We are all in this thing together. Whenever there's a threat that a child might make within a school, even if it's a threat that's on social media, the SRO is going to be very important in terms of determining the credibility of the threat.
Well, look, this is what a lot of people want to hear. They want this to be happening in their schools. But on the other hand, we're going to be hearing elsewhere in the program about a researcher who's studied shootings that have been thwarted. And he says that, in fact, what's needed in schools is a sense of compassion, a sense of openness, a sense that, you know, kids can come to people like therapists. What's not needed is more armament, more punitive symbols like police officers, because that shuts down what's needed to prevent these shootings, which is kids feeling that they can go tell on other kids. Your response to that?
The role of the school resource officer is not punitive. School resource officers are not a part of discipline within a school. The SRO's role within a school is not to take over the school, but his or her job is to support. We are a support staff. We are that extra set of eyes, that extra set of ears, that caring and compassionate adult that is assigned to the school.
Well, it sounds as if what Chris Bryant, again, at Hoover High in Alabama is saying is he loves his students. The president said that teachers love them more and suggested arming teachers. Now, your organization, NASRO, National Association of School Resource Officers, issued a statement. You're very much against arming teachers, first and foremost, because responding law enforcement could mistake a teacher for a shooter and kill them, that your SROs have constant retraining of use with a gun, which is necessary. They constantly have the gun on their person and it's secured. But you also say that a teacher won't be able to do what an SRO can do if they're trained for that, which is kill a student.
We must remember that the SRO is a police officer first. We have taken that oath to serve and protect. Although we can have a relationship with everyone within the school community, none of that stops us from doing our job. In fact, it makes us want to do our jobs even more. There is nothing in the world that is more sacred then when a parent drops that child off, I know that we are going through some very, very rough times now, and my thoughts and my prayers go out to the families in Florida. But even with that, schools in this country are still the safest places that we send our kids.
And I hear that you have had a surge in requests for training post the shooting last week in Parkland.
Absolutely. The National Association of School Resource Officers has the best training model in the nation. One of the blocks that I'm most proud of deals with adolescent child development. We have to understand that adolescent brain is not fully formed until the mid-20s. So it isn't to excuse the behavior of children. It is to have a greater understanding.
That's Don Bridges, president of the National Association of School Resource Officers. Don, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's a time of change in China, including the news this week that the Communist Party is poised to change the constitution so that President Xi Jinping can rule indefinitely. A lot of change is happening among China's millennial generation as well. Zach Deichwald has written about that in a new book called Young China. Deichwald is a 27-year-old American who studied in Hong Kong and now splits his time between New York and China. Zach, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Well, great to have you. And one of the reasons we're so happy to have you is because there are so many people in this country who are trying to have a better understanding of China. And I find that one of the biggest hurdles is that many of us do not speak the language. You decided to learn the language in China. What kind of a difference did that make in your ability to understand what was going on in the country?
Well, it's night and day. You know, if you're not able to communicate with people, you're not able to really get at the heart of their concerns. My goal or my idea of fluency was that if one of my friends was in crisis, was in a breakup, they would call me first and I'd be able to understand and console them. And then the next day, if I have to talk about nuclear deterrence because things are going off in North Korea, I'd be able to have that conversation too. It's absolutely essential to being able to understand and converse and gain legitimacy while you're there.
How difficult was it for you to learn the language?
It's a tough language. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but it's also extremely rewarding. Because it's so difficult, there aren't a lot of people who make it over sort of the advanced hump. And so everywhere I went, my language abilities was my key into people's homes, was my key into people's hearts. People would talk to me about their dreams, their aspirations, what keeps them up at night. Without the language, I wouldn't have been able to access even a fraction of that.
Well, and to give people an idea of the difficulty of the language, you mention in this book a poem called The Lion Eating Poet in the Stone Den. Just first of all, read a little bit of that.
Yeah, of course. So it's a classic poem, and it goes, shi 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 shi.
And these are all different words, right?
Right. They're all different words. So if you look at it on the page, it's clear that they're all different words, but they all have the same phoneme base with a different tone. So Chinese is a tonal language, has four tones. And so pitching your voice in a different direction will have an entirely different meaning. So the lion eating poet in the stone den is all communicated with the phoneme base of shi.
Well, good for you for learning how to do that. Now, we talk about the language. You focus in this book on young people in China. You've spoken to a lot of them. You spoke to people in your apartment complex or on the train or at restaurants. And one of the things that people brought up to you was that they were feeling pressure because they were the only children in their family. Of course, China has had the one-child policy for so long. But tell us a little bit about that and why people see that as a negative.
Sure. This young generation faces what people are calling the 4-2-1 crisis. What that means is there's four grandparents for every two parents for every one child. Now, it used to be in around 1950 that there were a lot of young people and not very many old people. The average life expectancy was 36. So you didn't get old, you just died. Because of a longevity revolution and because this young generation was the first generation born under the single child policy, China's sort of demographic pyramid has inverted. So now you have very few young people and an aging population. And now a lot of people interpret that to mean, wow, this young generation must get so much attention. But along with that attention comes an enormous amount of pressure to get ahead, pressure to get into a good college, pressure to get a great job, pressure to get married. So all of the attention that used to be dispersed to maybe 5 or 6 kids per family, which was the average in 1950, now it's all focused on that one child. So we call them little emperors, but for China's little emperors, heavy hangs the head that wears the crown.
And they resent
tough existence.
They resent being thought of in that way as little emperors.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you look at how gritty this young generation is, how much time and effort they put into their study, to getting ahead, to seeking opportunities, to being a responsible child to their parents, it is anything but a cushy lifestyle and upbringing.
You mentioned marriage and pressure to get married. What is it that Chinese millennials want out of marriage? Is it anything different than what people want in the West?
You know, China doesn't have religion, but it does have family. And so the pressure put on these kids, both men and women, but, you know, people my age in China, I'm born in 1990, to get married it's more than just, boy, that would be nice. We'll have something to tell the neighbor. In order to be a good person in China, they often sort of combine that with the idea of xiaoshun. Xiaoshun translates to filial piety. It's a poor translation because we would never use that in an everyday conversation here. But being good to your parents is an absolutely essential part of being a good person. And a large part of being a good child is having the next generation, ushering in the next generation. So getting married young, forming a family young, that's more the coming of age than turning 18, turning 21. It's an essential part of growing up in China. And becoming a grandparent in China is an essential part of growing old.
Is that strong family bond changing, or is that the way it's always been?
It's being put under tremendous pressure now. I often say this young generation is sort of at the fault line of two great tectonic plates. On one side, you have tradition, what it's meant to be Chinese for, you know, thousands of years. They have a strong, proud history. On the other side, you have the pressures of modernity. What does that mean? So for young women, for example, they're told that you have to get an education in this day and age, that you have to get a higher education, and that you shouldn't be dating because you need to be focusing on your studies. So you're in school till you're like 24, 25, and then bam, whiplash, you need to get ready to find a partner. Otherwise, by the age of 27, now it's getting pushed back to 30, you're considered shengnu, or a leftover woman. It means you're considered inedible by society. So that there's this traditional idea, which is get married, form a household. But then there's the pressures of what it means to be a person in today, which means you have to be educated in order to get a job. You have to continue to, you know, most families, both the mother and the father, are continuing to work. So there's the conflict of tradition and modernity that makes this, you know, I call them the restless generation. They're extremely aspirational, but there is tremendous amount of pressure sort of deciding what it means to be Chinese in the modern world.
Is there a Chinese approach to entrepreneurship that you think is different than here in the U.S.?
There's a really gutsy entrepreneurship movement in China right now. You're seeing a lot of young people, even those who are getting educated in the United States right now, wanting to go back to China because the opportunities feel so large. So in China, they'll say pinming, which means to put one's life on the line, putting their life on the line for success. There's a saying amongst the startup community in China. It's 996. That means they're working from 9 in the morning to 9 at night, 6 days a week. And that's just normal there.
At one point, you said you spoke with 100 Chinese people and asked them what their religion was. And most of them said money.
You know, they said it half jokingly, but there's enough truth to it. And there was a certain sadness with the response. You know, I would follow up with the questioning, obviously. And so much of the last 35 years, 37 years, 38 years of China's sort of post-reform and opening existence, so post-Mao existence, has been a move from rags to riches. You know, someone my age in China has witnessed such tremendous economic change. So I'm born in 1990. In the United States, I've watched our per capita GDP increase by 2.5 times. Really remarkable. Someone the same age as me in China has watched their per capita GDP increase 25 times. They remember the rags, and they've watched their country push towards riches. And with that, inevitably comes an overfocus on money and materialism. But this young generation is starting to react to that. They're not just asking subsistence questions. How am I going to get enough food? How do I provide shelter? And then, you know, the extension of that comes posturing with brands and materialism. They're now asking, what do I stand for? What do I believe in? What do I want for myself, my family, my country. They're identity questions.
And how do they feel about their government?
You know, it's a tricky question, but by and large, the opinion is their government is effective. Flawed, but effective. This young generation has had more experience of the outside world than any other generation in Chinese history. Their parents grew up behind a cultural wall without a view of the outside. This young generation grew up with the internet. They read our news. They watch our TV shows.
Some of it. They can't read the New York Times, for example. They can't go to Google.
Exactly. But more of it than you'd expect. You know, I have friends in China who quote Barney from How I Met Your Mother and Martin Luther King Jr. in the same breath. They're more fluent in our culture than we imagine. And like I said, there's so many exchange students here from China. There's 1 in 3 students studying in the United States are from China. So they have up close experience with the United States. And a lot of that experience has led them to believe that, you know what, no government is perfect, but ours gets things done.
What was the biggest surprise for you about China?
The word freedom was on the lips of pretty much every young person I talked to. You know, sometimes it was tattooed on their bodies. I have a friend who literally would write it on his ceiling so that it would be the last thing he would see before he goes to sleep and the first thing he would see every morning. And what I was most surprised by was that the freedom that they describe wanting is not freedom from an oppressive, restrictive government, as we so often expect, but rather freedom from an oppressive and restrictive set of cultural traditions. Again, these expectations about what a good life should look like that are informed by history but can't really play out in the modern world quite the way their parents expect. So it's that tension, the want to live the life that they imagine for themselves without feeling restricted by the ideas their parents and grandparents have of what they ought to be.
That's Zach Dykewald, whose book is called Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. Very interesting. Zach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy.
A beautiful wild flower grows in the swampy bogs of the southern Oregon coast, but the flower is endangered, and scientists are trying to figure out how to keep it from vanishing completely. Producer Jess Burns from Oregon Public Broadcasting and EarthFixed has the story.
The earth is squishy.
And that's that soft peat.
The wind is mosquito-y. And there's a flower the color of fire on the southern Oregon coast. It's called the Western Lily. Sherry Lair looks after the delicate flower across Oregon State Parks.
If the habitat's right, water's right, sunlight's right, they're gonna thrive.
The problem is land with this exact combination of characteristics is increasingly difficult to find. It's been eaten up by cranberry bogs and housing developments. What's left is often crowded by invasive plants. So there are only a few thousand flowers left, growing in isolated pockets in southern Oregon and northern California. At one of these sites on state land near Coos Bay, Lair pushes through the thigh-high brush.
There's a lot of little babies in the trails, so keep your eyes open.
She points out a single 3-inch tall leaf, as easy to tread on as a blade of grass. The lilies here were mostly grown in a nursery and planted to reestablish them on this protected land. But there's only a few dozen of the curled red and yellow flowers hanging from thin, bent stems in the clearing. Managers don't know exactly why, but they have a suspect.
Deer.
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 Deer. Lots and lots of deer here.
Madeline Vanderheiden is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
So after the flower is done with its beautiful show of blooms, it becomes this nice, what we call a fruit, and that really seems to be like candy to these deer.
So what to do? Biologists are currently experimenting with one idea, using cages. They're lightweight and wood-framed, about large enough for an old-school VW bug. Lair says there's lilies inside and out.
Pretty soon we're going to send someone in here to count everything that's going on in here and what's going on next to it to see if the deer are decimating them or having no impact on them, or somewhere right in between that.
That's where a field crew from Coos Watershed Association comes in. Ryan Cook and James Orr call out the lilies they see in and around one of the cages.
One, one,
One.
Cars and trucks pass a few dozen yards away. Lexi Snell records the count, noting the telltale sign that something hungry has passed by.
These two stems have been browsed, and so usually it's a deer or an elk that will come here and just bite the flower off the top of it.
The crew sees mixed results at the seven test sites. The deer have hit some hard. Others appear untouched. Still at others, mysteriously, it's difficult to find any plants at all, even in the cages. And with still so much unknown about the endangered western lily, this is the way efforts to conserve the plant go. Just when everything seems perfect, it's not. Again, biologist Madeline Vanderheiden.
Some of the sites that were previously known to have lilies have started to blink out and decline. Despite the fact we've discovered some new populations, I think overall the trend is still downward.
And so the pressure is on to protect the showy Oregon native, growing at home in the mud and the muck. For Here and Now, I'm Jess Burns.
Yesterday, we spoke with John Ledoux of Minnesota. We highly recommend you listen at herenow.org. He's one of dozens of thwarted school attackers. He had bombs ready to go in 2014 when he was caught. He described to us his slow decline from good student.
It kind of bothered me watching people mess around, and I wasn't enjoying things. I looked around and people were enjoying stuff, and I was just kind of living day to day, just existing. So it was more fueled by my slew of disappointment and frustration that led me to want to be violent is because I wanted to feel satisfaction through dominance, basically.
John was later diagnosed with different syndromes. He has medication and coping skills to help him overcome his irrational lack of self-worth. He's embarrassed he even thought of hurting others. He said it may have made a difference if someone had talked to him about how twisted his thinking was. He also talked of a friend who abandoned an attack just because a student was nice to him. Our next guest says we could be learning more from these thwarted attackers. Eric Madfist is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He's also author of Risk of School Rampage, Assessing and Preventing Threats of School Violence. He joins us by Skype. Eric, you also cautioned these mass attacks, horrific as they are rare.
Yeah, that's true. So if we're talking about sort of school shootings in general, the vast majority of them actually occur in sort of urban schools and often over more sort of mundane things like over drugs or things like that or gangs. And those get very little attention, whereas these school rampage shootings where lots of people are killed get a lot more attention, but are actually much more likely to occur in suburban schools and rural schools. But again, they're still pretty rare events.
Well, as you write, any given school can expect to experience a student homicide about once every 6,000 years. So we want to stress that. But what did you find in studying and speaking to, I found it so fascinating to listen to John Ledoux, in speaking to young men in particular who had planned an attack but had been foiled. What do you start to learn about who these young people are?
I mean, the vast majority are boys. And so I do think that looking at forms of toxic masculinity, why it is boys lash out in this way. And you know, his quote right here, right? He was disappointed and frustrated, led me to want to be violent. It's because I wanted to feel satisfaction through dominance, basically. And so a lot of it is about you've failed in other avenues of your life. You can't be popular. You're not necessarily financially successful, whatever it may be, that would be traditional avenues of performing your masculinity. Instead, you do the show of power. And a lot of it does have to do with boys who feel emasculated. So I do think looking at the gender dynamics and particularly having mental health counseling and these kind of approaches that look at masculinity is really important.
They might be someone who's moved from a small nurturing school to a larger school, or they might be someone who's just left school and be thrust from a school where they had issues. For instance, John Ledoux, nobody knew
sure.
What was going on in his mind. And now they're thrust into like the workplace world and they can't cope.
Yeah. So and that's also true if we talk about mass shooters more generally. They do tend to be people who have experienced lots of frustrations throughout their lives. They tend to be people who have not been successful in the way that they want to be. But in school shooters, there is a number of cases where people have been suspended or expelled or something like that beforehand, which act as sort of like a last straw before these attacks. So that's not atypical. Yeah.
Well, talk a little bit about what you've learned, and you just said people who've been suspended or expelled, and the thing that we hear all the time, that in many cases, there's been a pattern of concern about someone who becomes a school shooter. We're thinking of Sandy Hook or, you know, recently in Florida.
Yeah.
What is your observation about what's the best way to prevent this?
I think in particular what we know is what actually averted these attacks. When I looked at these schools across the country, what it really was people coming forward when they had been exposed to some sort of threat that they had heard about, whether that's a kid. And in the majority of cases, there is some form of what the Secret Service called leakage, some form of a kid telling someone else what they're going to do, either by threatening them or trying to convince them to join up on their plot, things like that. That happens in the vast majority of cases. And it's when kids come forward to the authorities, to sometimes to parents, to teachers, to sometimes school resource officers to report this behavior. That's actually what averts these situations. And what we also know from tons of research across education and criminal justice and sociology and all these fields, that the best way to encourage reporting behavior is positive school environments. And you have a school environment that doesn't cramp down and is not excessively punitive in terms of its discipline, doesn't have zero tolerance policies. When it has an environment that people feel comfortable coming to the adults in the building, that students feel comfortable with, that they can trust the people, that they're not going to get in trouble themselves, that's when they come forward. And so having a more cramped down security style environment actually makes kids less likely to come forward and makes school shootings more likely to happen.
Well, let's hear that again, because that's what jumped out at me, that you say that the more you institutionalize a school, the more you make it a police state, the less students feel that ineffable thing, that there's someone there that cares about them, that there's a teacher that will be willing to sit with them at lunch. I mean, I've been reading about teachers who are saying, the way that I try to protect students is I look for the kid who has no one to sit with them at lunch. And, you know, that kind of attitude. And, you know, some teachers might say, well, that's not my job to be a social worker. But your point seems to be the less a punitive environment, the more a comforting environment, the better chance you have of finding those people and preventing a shooting.
Yeah, some of it comes from restorative justice and implying restorative discipline principles to schools. And so that also applies even if you have, like, you know, the type of resource officers that you have and who's working in those arenas. So that it's not someone who's just particularly punitive, but who has a relationship with kids, but also the atmosphere of the school broadly and that the way that they treat their kids in terms of discipline.
Well, but you just mentioned something, resources. I mean, these have to be people who know what they're doing when they're informed of a child who might have serious emotional issues. It can't just be any regular teacher. It sounds like you're saying that money and resources should go to social workers or therapists within schools. With many schools, this is commonplace, but some schools don't have on-campus therapists.
Or even smaller class sizes. Sort of, there's lots of this research into sort of the ratios of guidance counselors, but also even of teachers, that show that these kind of problems are lessened, or kids are more likely to come forward and deal with these kinds of issues when you have smaller class sizes. So even on that level, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because you write that post-Columbine, 1999, people think that students are aware that they can't any longer have this code of silence that students have always had. And you write, no, they are not coming forward, because the environment's become so frightening and punitive. By the way, you also note two new preventive approaches to threat assessment. In other words, assessing what's going on here. One is from a professor, Dewey Cornell. It's called the Virginia Threat Assessment Guideline. Another is the Network Against School Shootings, also known as the Berlin Leaking Project, which has been, as you said, a great source in Germany about school threats. Can you just distill it down? What's new? What should people know?
In general, all of this stuff is under the sort of umbrella of violence risk assessment. The problem is there are various forms of violence risk assessment that are based on aggregate data and sometimes sort of stereotypes that are problematic. So the idea that there's a profile of school shooters and we have to follow people who dress differently or wear trench coats or stuff like that, or like, you know, different kinds of music, that's problematic and not really empirically based. In contrast, we can talk about threat assessment, which is sort of a more specific thing where you're actually looking at the substance of the threat itself, how detailed the threat was, was, how actionable, how doable the threat was. If you threat to, you know, threaten to blow up the moon, that's not a sort of realistic threat, right? But if you've actually taken actions to engage in that threat, so if you've actually collected weapons, you've sort of written extensively about your plans to do it, those are the kind of threats that you take more seriously than someone just sort of randomly offhandedly saying you want to kill someone, or a threat that doesn't have the same kind of detail or realistic sort of actions taken behind it. So looking at the substance of the threat to sort of assess how serious it is.
But by the way, we're hearing about the Florida shooter. People are so bewildered because they've been saying that, you know, the family that he lived with, for instance, he seemed so happy recently. He seemed the best he ever was. Is it somewhat like suicide? We hear that when people finally make up their mind to do something, they actually are lightened. I mean, the fact that somebody is suddenly in a, you know, one of the best moods they've been in doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to do something. It may mean that they are, and they're relieved they don't have to worry about it anymore.
Sure. No, I think that makes some sense. I mean, certainly a lot of school shooters and mass shooters are also suicidal. They often will kill themselves at the end of the act or commit suicide by cop. So I think there are definitely some similarities there.
Eric Matfis, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Washington, Tacoma, also the author of Risk of School Rampage, Assessing and Preventing Threats of School Violence. And again, he rushes to say they are so rare, but so frightening when they do happen. Eric, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
California will soon allow driverless cars to operate without a driver. The state's Department of Motor Vehicles announced yesterday that it will eliminate a requirement for autonomous cars to have a person behind the wheel in the event of an emergency. The new rules go into effect on April 2nd. For more on this and other tech news, let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode and joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
So 50 companies in the state of California are licensed to test self-driving cars. They'll be affected. Tell us more about this rule change.
So it's a pretty big change in terms of allowing these companies. Companies like Google, for example, they have a division called Waymo for self-driving cars, as well as, you know, established companies like GM to start doing fully autonomous or fully driverless cars. At the same time, what this requirement does allow for, though, is they have to have sort of a remote operator, so someone in sort of like a signal tower who can sort of monitor and manage these cars should they get into an accident or some kind of other problem.
And what's happened to make regulators more confident in driverless car safety?
Well, companies like GM and Google have been testing in limited sort of areas and limited roads for some time already. So it's not as if they haven't sort of developed some expertise here. But the main thing is that these companies have been lobbying for some years now. And in order to sort of really develop autonomous cars in a real way, they need real-world experience. And I think it frankly just comes down to the companies pestering the regulators for it. It's also the future, right? I think if you're in government, you should see that this is the future. It's better to sort this out now than later. And at some point, you just have to test it for real.
Are other states likely to follow suit?
Yeah, other states have already started looking more closely at this and have also offered limited testing. Nevada, for example, as well as Michigan. So I think the more roads, the more different conditions that these companies sort of see in their testing, the better these autonomous cars will get. So it sort of behooves, you know, governments to kind of open up the testing to a wider array of companies and also in a wider field of areas to go into as well.
I want to get to another story in the tech sector. A federal appeals court ruled yesterday to allow the Federal Trade Commission to move forward in a lawsuit against AT&T. This is about people who have unlimited data plans and were allegedly getting their speed throttled.
So this is very complicated. It really comes down to jurisdictional sort of issues, right? What is the FTC allowed to do, especially after the FCC sort of relinquished net neutrality, right? And I think in this particular case, the FTC sort of went after AT&T's marketing practices, which the FTC already has purview to do. AT&T was looking for a loophole where they basically said, well, we're a common carrier, what's known as a common carrier, so you don't have any jurisdiction here. The courts basically ruled in favor of the FTC and said, no, they do have jurisdiction here. They can sort of have the room to look at this. Here's the thing, though. Let's not confuse this with net neutrality. This doesn't mean that FTC will have purview over net neutrality. That's a slightly different set of rules that ultimately, you know, it will have to be done by Congress, right? And Republicans control Congress, and they really haven't advocated for net neutrality, at least in the way it's been traditionally defined. So it's a long walk to get there, but a slight win for the FTC, but net neutrality is still up in the air.
It also really makes you think about the value of these unlimited data plans, whether you're really getting unlimited data if you've got one of those.
Right, exactly. And that was what was at issue here, is that, you know, AT&T was selling unlimited data plans, but they were not informing the public, to the customers, that, well, we might throttle your traffic or slow down some traffic if you have that plan.
So there's also news about Apple. Over the weekend, Reuters reported that the company will hold iCloud encryption key data in China. First of all, explain what that means and tell us about the concerns there.
Yet more complications. So to be clear, this affects specifically and only Chinese users. So if you are a customer in China, own an iPhone, and you participate in Apple's iCloud program, where you can sort of store digitally your photos and messages, almost anything, into the cloud, into the Apple cloud service, the keys that sort of unlock that data for your account will be kept in China, as well as all the data itself. And, you know, the concerns are that, well, this could give the Chinese government access to your data if and when they so choose. No one's necessarily denying that. And this is based on a new law that China instituted that Apple is complying with. Apple, you know, sort of lobbied against that law, saying this could weaken customer privacy. But the rules are different in China. I think there's a different regime. There's a different idea. There's a different sort of threshold for what the government is allowed to do versus in the United States. And I think that's the heart of the issue. And if you want to operate in China, you have to abide by China's laws. And a fifth of Apple's sales come from China.
Right.
So, of course, they're going to do that.
And what about Samsung? Finally, Samsung revealed its new flagship phone, the Galaxy S9. We, of course, remember the S7, or the Galaxy Note 7, was having some trouble bursting into flames. What do we know about the new one?
Well, so no bursting into flames this time, at least not yet. You know, the reception has been lukewarm from reviewers. They say, of course, it's a nicer, better phone, but it's not that much different. I mean, the hardware is slightly nicer, slightly sleeker, all that kind of stuff. But in terms of the software, ultimately, that's what we're seeing, is that, you know, going forward, all the hardware is all really nice and sort of on par to some degree. The things that now set phones apart are going to be price, in terms of how cheap that might be, and then the types of content, the types of software and apps that are available on those phones. And I think that'll be the bigger differentiator going forward.
That's Ed Lee, managing editor at Recode. Ed, thank you.
Anytime.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.